Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The president says the time for real health care reform is now. Washington has heard that before, but this time we're told is really different. The political will is there. The economic stakes are higher than ever. But as Congress gets down to business, the obstacles are thick. How to really control costs and expand coverage. Public plans versus private. The government's own role. Will serious reform make it through the proverbial sausage factory this time? This hour on Point, the real politics of healthcare reform. Joining me now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Jonathan Cohn. He's a senior editor at The New Republic and author of the magazine's healthcare blog called The Treatment. He's also a senior fellow at the think tank Demos and author of the 2007 book Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Jonathan Cohn, thanks for joining us. Welcome.
I'm happy to be here.
So we heard the president yesterday. Congress is getting down to business on health care as well. You watch this so closely. Why is health care reform front and center right now?
Well, it's front and center right now, most importantly, because we have a health care crisis in this country. People are losing their coverage. It's becoming more expensive. Businesses are struggling under the burden. And looking forward, we're looking at a situation where our government has a severe fiscal crisis going forward. Our society has a severe fiscal crisis going forward. We are going to owe a lot of money in the future paying for health care unless we do something about it. And so we're trying to – we have a new president. We have a new Congress. And everybody knows, everybody who's followed this history knows that you get one shot at this typically in a presidency to deal with this problem. It's in that first year. And so they're going for it.
So where does legislation and health care reform stand then in Washington right now?
Well, you know, I've been saying all along from, you know, from the beginning, from the early, that the chances of health care reform passing this year are better than they have been at any time in history, going all the way back to the 1930s when our health insurance system first came into existence. And at the same time, that health care reform is still a difficult proposition and that the chances are probably around 50-50. I feel like that's the case now. To be clear, I would bet large amounts of money that sometime at the end of this year, October, November, December, there's going to be a signing ceremony at the White House. Hmm. This White House is determined to get a win. But the question is what they get. Are they there to sign a small pilot demonstration project, or are they there to sign the kind of sweeping overhaul that they say they want, that the Democratic leaders in Congress say they want? But obviously that's very difficult to get through.
You say chances are better than at any other time, really, in recent memory. So many people remember health care reform from 15 years ago from the Clinton effort, Hillary Rodham Clinton. How is this round of health care reform different from that effort, 1993-94?
We have a couple of very important factors. First, the problem is worse. We have more people without health insurance. It's eating up a larger share of our incomes, both individually, again, as businesses, as a society. So the problem is worse. People are more eager for change. The interest groups who are part of this discussion, the health industry groups, they all have their perspective on this. They want to protect their income streams, but at a fundamental level, most of them have bought into the idea that something has to change, and they are still playing nice and being part of the conversation, relatively speaking, and seeing, trying to see this through rather than trying to simply obstruct it. Most important, I think, the politics have changed. You look at the country, we've just elected a Democratic president who's extremely popular as we come to the middle of this fight, much more popular, I would say, than Bill Clinton was at a similar stage. They've avoided the strategic mistakes that the Clinton administration made. In fact, they spent a lot of time studying those mistakes. Hmm. And Congress, frankly, is a lot more friendly to it than it was 15 years ago. Just if you look at who's in the Congress and the numbers, this is a more progressive Congress that is more committed to doing something about this.
So what are the bills? What are the proposals that are being put forward at this point?
Well, you know, it's important to remember we're at the stage in the process, the sausage making, when it's going to look like a mess. I mean, you go to Capitol Hill, you will see, whoa, there's the Senate Finance Committee's got its bill and the Senate Help Committee. And then over in the House, they got the three committees doing their bill. And then there's what President Obama proposed. And then there's this senator and that senator.
Right.
That's all true. But in the big picture sense, there's really only one proposal moving through Congress right now. If you look at what the three House committees, the two Senate committees, what President Obama talked about in the campaign, they are all basically talking about the same essential structure for reform with a couple of variations. But in general, the idea is to say people who get insurance from large employers, let them keep it. And then create some kind of system where everybody else can get insurance that looks like the coverage that people who work for large employers get. And so by that, I mean it would have good benefits. It would be available to everyone at one price, regardless if they had pre-existing conditions. And the questions, the debate such that we're having now is not over that basic structure. It's about the details. Well, how much do you want to offer subsidies to people so that people who don't make as much money can have financial assistance buying this insurance? Should there be an option for everybody to enroll in a public insurance plan, which is something that might look a little bit like Medicare? And the idea would be to have this public insurance plan essentially compete with private insurance. So that's where the debate is. And obviously, as you add more things to the reform, you also have to think more about, well, how are you going to pay for it? Because it costs money.
It does. And we'll get to that. I want to go back to this public option and why it is so controversial. President Obama talked about that yesterday in his press conference, and he insisted that a public option for health care would not hurt private business.
For us to be able to say, here's a public option that's not profit-driven, that can keep down administrative costs, and that provides you good quality care for a reasonable price as one of the options for you to choose, I think that makes sense.
Wouldn't that drive private insurers out of business?
Well, why would it drive private insurers out of business? If private insurers say that the marketplace provides the best quality health care, if they tell us that they're offering a good deal, then why is it that the government, which they say can't run anything, suddenly is going to drive them out of business? That's not logical.
Jonathan Cohn, is he right? Public option driving private insurance out of business?
Well, I think, you know, the basic dynamic he's describing is right. I mean, this is the idea, is to say, look, we're going to put this public plan in there to compete with the private insurers. And, you know, if they should be able to keep up. Now, not all private insurers will be able to keep up. I think part of the reason to do this is we recognize going in that not all private insurance is very good. I mean, this is one reason a lot of people want a public insurance option. So you put this public insurance option in there as a benchmark and say, look, this is what we want insurance to do. It has to, you know, provide these benefits. It has to make itself available to everyone and really make itself available to everyone at a fair price. Now, there are going to be private insurers that can do that pretty easily. And in fact, I've always suspected, you won't get them to say this on the record, but some of the larger insurers out there, they can make peace with that, and they can live, and they can coexist, and they can thrive, and they'll hold on to a nice share of the business, and they'll compete back and forth, and actually it'll be a nice competitive dynamic. There are things that public insurance will probably do particularly well. There might be some things that the private insurers will do well, and they'll compete back and forth. It'll be a nice, vibrant workplace. And when you're done with this process, you'll have better insurance for everyone. Some of them will be in public insurance, and some people will be in private insurance, but it'll be a set of options that is uniformly good insurance, and that's really what we care about.
There is bipartisan opposition to public health care in the Senate, and I want to hear now from ABC's This Week on Sunday with George Stephanopoulos. This is Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham speaking about that.
I don't think it's just going to be Republicans. You got Senator Conrad talking about a co-op. You've got other Democrats running away from the government-run health care where the bureaucrat stands between the doctor and the patient. I think this idea is unnerving to the members of the Senate, and it will be to the public when they understand what it means, that you'll wait longer to get treated and you'll get the health care the government decides for you, not that of your doctor. So, yes, I think this idea needs to go away and replace it with something maybe like Kent Conrad's proposal. No.
Jonathan Cohn, what is Kent Conrad's proposal?
Well, Kent Conrad, just so our listeners know, Kent Conrad is the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. He's a Democrat from North Dakota, but he's a fairly conservative Democrat. And he has said, look, I don't think there are votes to create a true public plan like Obama has been describing, like I just described. So we need to come up with some compromise version. And his idea was to come up with a co-op. Now, I have to say, watching this debate, I had the distinct impression that he kind of threw that name out there. This was a concept that someone brought up at a meeting the day before. It really wasn't very fleshed out. I'm not sure he knew what he was talking about. What's interesting to me is that immediately most of the people who favor a public plan said, well, this is not a public plan. A few people said, all right, let's take Senator Conrad at his word here and let's try this co-op idea. What does it mean? And they kind of fleshed it out. And people said, well, you know, a co-op could do what we want this public plan to do as long as it had the following characteristics. It had to be national. It had to be sufficiently funded. And the interesting thing is, as soon as it started to take on some of these characteristics, as soon as you gave this co-op the power to do what we want a public plan to do, immediately it became very apparent that the conservatives, the Republicans who had expressed some interest in it, were immediately backing off like, whoa, we don't want it. So, I mean, I think the co-op is whatever you want it to be. But I think to people who support the public plan, a co-op is another way to do a public plan. And to people who oppose a public plan, a co-op is a way to not have a public plan. So I don't really know that it advances the debate. I think at the end of the day, this is going to be a up or down sort of, you know, we're going to say we're either going to have this or we're not going to have it. We'll call it a co-op. We'll call it a national plan. I don't know. We'll call it a banana. I don't care. But, you know, it's going to be either a public plan or it won't be. And it's going to come down to the votes.
It also comes down to the cost here and the centerpiece of all this, $1 trillion over 10 years. Is that the working number really going forward, Jonathan?
You know, it really depends on how you structure the plan. And it's funny how everyone's gotten fixated on $1 trillion. You know, a friend of mine noted if we all had 12 fingers and toes, we'd be fixated on, you know, 1.2 trillion because, you know, 10 fingers and toes, 1 trillion, 1.2. There's no magic reason why it has to be $1 trillion as opposed to 1.2. The best estimates I've seen to do this right, you're probably talking about 1.2, 1.3 trillion. It sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. But when you consider that every year how much we spend trillions on healthcare alone, to spend an extra $1 trillion over 10 years actually isn't that much, particularly if it's going to help you save money in the long term.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Congress getting serious on health care reform. We're joined this hour by Jonathan Cohn, senior editor at The New Republic and author of its health care blog called The Treatment, also author of the 2007 book Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Also joining us now from Washington is Gail Wilensky. She's an economist and senior fellow at Project HOPE, an international health education foundation. She's recently served as a member of the World Health Organization's Commission on the Social Determinants of Health, and she was an advisor to John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign and helped write the McCain health care plan. She also advised President George H.W. Bush on health care and welfare policy. Gail Wilensky, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what, to your mind, what are the biggest problems with the current healthcare system as it relates to fixing it?
We have 15% of our population that doesn't have coverage. We have unsustainable healthcare spending growth that's going to put tremendous pressure on the federal budget funding Medicare and Medicaid. You didn't mention it, but I ran the Medicare program in the early 1990s. I got to experience the kinds of pressures that program generates. And we also don't have the kind of quality and clinical appropriateness provided to our patients and citizens in this country. So we need to take on some very serious problems, making sure everyone has coverage, but at least importantly, maybe in some ways more importantly, making sure we have sustainable health care programs and get better value for what we spend.
So to your mind, do the plans under consideration in Congress address the problems that you mentioned?
Most of the plans are focusing, not surprisingly now, more on expanding coverage and how to pay for it. That's important. But much less on how to have sustainable spending and improve the value, move more to chronic care management, and make sure that we are getting better value for the money we spend. That is getting a little lip service, not a lot of attention, though we don't really know because we actually haven't been able to see very much detail in the plans that are under consideration.
Well, okay, yes. And so to your point, do you worry that the reform being discussed will improve cost, quality of care, or simply expand coverage, leaving us with a larger and more expensive version of what we've already got?
I think right now it's likely the first round legislation will primarily expand coverage. and push off much of the consideration about cost and improving quality in some ways, like what we saw go on in Massachusetts, which has been much more successful at expanding coverage to 97% of its citizens and is now just beginning to take on the issue of how to have a sustainable program and improve the value.
Is it really a good program? I mean, we're in Massachusetts and we hear all the time it doesn't have the money to sustain the promises it's made to its people.
That is a lesson for us going forward. It did its first round objective, try to get coverage. I believe the number is estimated about 97% of the people in Massachusetts have coverage. It has not taken on the much more difficult issues of how to sustain the program over time and how to improve the value. Healthcare is a very big issue in Massachusetts. What I've been told when I was up at the Kennedy School talking about what we could learn from Massachusetts for national reform is that about 1 out of 5 jobs in Massachusetts are associated with healthcare. That means as you try to slow down spending, which we need to do, you better be careful how you do it. Too blunt an instrument could have a very severe consequence with regard to increasing unemployment.
Jonathan Cohn, to your mind, what is the lesson from the Massachusetts healthcare experiment?
Well, you know, first of all, I would say just to take a polite, make a polite disagreement with Gail, who by the way is one of the smartest people I know on healthcare. So I take everything she says very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. I do think the discussion at the national level right now is a little more focused on cost than the discussion in Massachusetts several years ago was. I mean, there's a serious push from the White House to focus on cost and quality. Now, it's an open question whether that will emerge from the legislation. Congress, I suspect, is not nearly as enthusiastic about it. A lot of people get donations from the hospitals and from the drug makers and from the providers who would have to change their behavior. So that part of the skepticism, I agree with it. But at the very least, I would say there's more of a focus on doing costs right now in the Washington conversation than I think there was in Massachusetts. I would also say this about Massachusetts. I would agree that in general, they didn't deal with costs. They did expand coverage. I think, you know, number one, that's good. I mean, not that it's good that they left out the cost part. It's good that they expanded coverage. I mean, all things being equal, I will take a world where we have covered most people and can't control cost versus a world where we don't cover most people and can't control cost. That's still, I consider that a net step forward. But the other thing to remember, and this is something I've heard from people in Massachusetts, is that they are looking at costs right now. And part of the reason they're looking at costs is that they've done the coverage part of the equation. And there's every reason to believe that if you deal with coverage, it makes possible a better conversation about cost for any number of reasons. And don't forget also, I mean, and this is a sort of truism of health policy, it is really hard to control costs at the state level. So much of the money going into our healthcare system comes from Washington that if you're one state trying to make this happen, it's hard to do. I think the chances of doing something about costs at the national level are better. They have a better shot at doing this right in Washington than Massachusetts ever did.
Gail Wilensky, talk about that. Talk about the cost. You say we're in sticker shock mode right now nationally. I mean, where do we go? How do we pay for this?
Well, there are two issues, and people need to understand they're really separate ones. One is, how do we pay for the expansion? Massachusetts was able to do it because they had some extra federal money that was available through a waiver they were going to lose, and the government decided to allow them to use it for their expansion. Plus, they had an uncompensated care pool of money available to them. First, we need to figure out how to pay for the expansion of bringing the other 15% of the population in. But then, as Jonathan mentioned, we've got to then think about how to slow spending for all of us. And there is no easy answer. It means changing the incentives that physicians face in terms of the type of reimbursement they get under Medicare. Very disaggregated fee-for-service payment where the more you do, the more complex the procedure you do, the more you get paid. Having very little incentive to provide wellness and preventive care for populations, for people to keep them healthy, much more payment for doing complicated procedures like joint replacements, knee replacements, and cardiac bypass procedures. The whole reimbursement system needs to get changed. We need to get people much more involved in taking care of themselves. We need to have a focus on prevention and healthier lifestyles. It is going to take a lot of changes because it is very different from how medicine has been practiced for a long time, and it's not going to happen overnight. So it is a lot of steps to change the incentives that physicians, hospitals, individuals face in order to get a different outcome than we now get. But it's different from paying for the initial expansion. We need to do that. That just brings us in. That brings us to where Massachusetts is, which is now that you've got everybody in, you really face the full effects of having unsustainable health care spending and not enough value for what you spend.
Let me bring some callers into the conversation, health care consumers themselves. First, let's go to Bob. He's in Burlington, Vermont. Bob, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. A trillion here, a trillion there, it doesn't really matter. It's going to come out of my paycheck one way or the other, either as an increased tax or as an increased premium for my coverage now. But my question, and you touched on it just a little bit, is, with all the societal changes that we're trying to implement now, don't they all go back to the fact that if we don't institute meaningful and broad-ranging campaign finance reform, we're just kind of whistling through the graveyard and, you know, pushing that ball up the hill, and it always wants to roll back down. How are we implementing or dealing with that type of problem in this discussion?
Bob, thanks. Jonathan Cohn, would you answer?
Well, I think there's no question that the influence of special interests on politics changes the way our politics works. I mean, look, there are a lot of polls that suggest that people are generally pretty supportive of the idea of a public insurance option. Now, it depends a lot on how you ask the question. But in general, I think there is a fair amount of support out there. Congress is much – the Senate in particular is much more skeptical of it. Now, there's every reason to believe that has something to do with campaign donations, whether it's members of the Senate, you know, listening to their donors, or simply the fact that campaign special interests tend to finance campaigns for people who support their views and get them elected. So in the long run, yeah, I mean, we, you know, I would love campaign finance reform. The fact is that's – another big problem, tough to do, and right now we don't have a system where we've really gotten money out of politics, so you do the best you can. And actually within those confines, like I said, I think the prospects for doing something, and not just doing something, but doing something reasonably meaningful are pretty good.
Back to the cost, Jonathan, for a minute. The president says that health care reform will be deficit neutral. Is that possible? Is it possible any plan will be passed without raising taxes?
Well, those are two different things. Deficit neutral means that we pay for it. We might very well have to raise taxes to make it deficit neutral.
How we pay for it, right.
Yeah, that's a question of how we pay for it. I think it's entirely possible to deficit neutral. I think the message the White House is sending, and they're sending this message privately, not just publicly, they are dead serious about this. Let me tell you, there are people, a lot of people in Congress who would be very happy to punt and just, you know, run up higher deficits on this, maybe on the argument that it's worth spending. And the White House has laid down a very clear marker on this. They do not want to sign a bill that is not paid for. So they are determined to get a deficit neutral. I think it's far more likely that at the end of the day we will see a less ambitious plan to keep it deficit neutral rather than go with a more ambitious plan if it means running deficits. And now that will probably mean it will mean taking a lot of money out of the healthcare system one way or another. I think you probably will see some new revenue on the table. Personally, I think that's probably appropriate.
Back to the phones. Mark is in Hingham, Massachusetts. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding the public option. Would there be parameters on it, or in what kind would there be? In other words, if the government can just pour money into the public plan and not have to and not be accountable for any sort of, you know, cash flow, you know, not call it a profit, but then it sort of undermines what President Obama said in the press conference. But if there are some kinds of constraints, say chartered into the, you know, the formation of the public option, then it's a different story. Mm-hmm. Then it supports what he says, and it's a more real world situation.
Mark, thank you. It's a good point. Gail Walensky, will you speak to that? Will there be parameters to a public option plan?
There will be legislation setting it up. The question is, the initial legislation may or may not carry through with further Congresses. One Congress can't bind the hands of another. We see this happening now in Part D, there was provision that had the Secretary not involved in negotiating prices. That is likely to be removed. A lot of Democrats didn't like it in the first place. The point is that whatever the parameters that are put on in the Congress that writes the legislation, can be removed in a subsequent a session of Congress. And it really goes to what it is you think a public plan will or will not accomplish, and whether or not there are other better ways to accomplish it or not. And there'll be a lot more discussion about that. Jonathan earlier had attributed the Senate's interest in the public plan to campaign finances and donors. I don't receive campaign finances and donors, and I am not someone who believes a public plan is necessary. There are ways to solve the same problems with other techniques. So it's not just people who receive donor contributions that have raised questions about the appropriateness of a public plan.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Thanks for that, Gail. Let's go back to the phones. Andrew is on the line. He's in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Andrew, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So as a son of two physicians, I've watched healthcare reform, whether it's from government regulating incentives pharmaceutical companies can provide physicians to having physicians use electronic records to reduce costs. My question is, why all the focus on providing a new type of insurance when I believe the cost of healthcare in the U.S. primarily stems from the huge legal costs that physicians incur and have to defend themselves against, for example, malpractice suits. That provides a huge power to the patient over the physician that, you know, in my opinion, incurs a, you know, a too high cost for the physician, which is then translated into higher costs for healthcare and insurance being unable to be provided to the entire population.
Hmm.
So just to reiterate, you know, why the focus on an overarching healthcare plan.
All right, Andrew. Thank you. Jonathan Cohn, would you speak to that? Eliminating administrative costs partly.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, and in terms of malpractice, I mean, this is actually, this gets a lot of attention, particularly among members of the medical community for obvious reasons, understandable reasons. A lot of experts have looked at this question. The overwhelming evidence on this, if you talk to economists, is that malpractice is not a major reason for the is not the major single most important or even one of the top reasons why our healthcare is so expensive, and that's true even if you take into account defensive medicine. Now, defensive medicine is something that's hard to measure. It would not shock me to learn that, in fact, the studies don't capture all of the added costs. So, you know, I actually think there's a case for doing something about malpractice, in part because, I mean, people who look at the malpractice system will tell you it doesn't really serve patients particularly well. It doesn't promote quality. And in fact, there has been talk in the middle of this discussion about some kind of change to malpractice, doing it in such a way that it both improves the quality of care long run and makes sure that people who are victims of medical errors, not necessarily intentional negligence, get some compensation, maybe through some kind of no-fault system or something like that. So I think there's a lot of support out there for doing something about malpractice, something intelligent, which I don't know that some of the proposals you hear out there aren't so intelligent. At the same time, I think it's important to recognize that even if we do something about malpractice, and again, I say this as someone who is generally friendly to the idea, that's not really going to take care of the majority of the cost problem we're experiencing. There are other factors, as the ones Gail talked about before, about the incentives in our system for how we treat and realigning the way we pay for medical care.
Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius testified this morning before a House Energy and Commerce Committee, and I'd like to hear what she says about the discussion for reform.
Health reform constitutes one of our most important domestic priorities, and we know the cost of doing nothing is simply too high. As the President has said, unless we fix what's broken in our current system, everyone's health care is in jeopardy. Reform is not a luxury, it's a necessity. Today in America, we have by far the most expensive health system in the world. We spend 50% more per person than the average developed country, spending more on health care than housing or food.
Sebelius talking about the need for reform. Indeed, it's how to get there. Here is House Republican Ohio Representative and Minority Leader John Boehner yesterday blasting the Democrats' health plans.
Congress shouldn't rush through health care like we did with the stimulus plan several months ago. A Washington takeover of health care, I think, will limit the flexibility of our states and hurt working families around our country. When it comes to health care, I think most people want to preserve the doctor-patient relationship and not have some government-run system where you've got bureaucrats here in Washington telling doctors just what types of prescriptions they should write.
Jonathan Cohn, how divided is Congress? Where do Democrats and Republicans stand at this point?
Well, you know, I mean, politics is a fluid thing. So, you know, where they were yesterday may not be where they were today. In general, I think there is a strong support within the Democratic Party for doing something. I think the two Republicans in general in the House are mostly opposed. I think in the Senate there are a few members of the Republican caucus in the Senate who are interested in talking about doing something. It is not clear to me where their support for reform stops. In general, I've been telling people, you know, we talk a lot about this public option because it gets all this attention, and I think it's important. And to be clear, I think you can oppose it for any number of good reasons, although I support it. But, you know, I think the real flashpoints here are going to come. I mean, you want to know where the flashpoints, where the dividing lines are. I think as much as it's going to be about the money. Mm-hmm. How much money does it cost to do this? And are people willing to put the funding on the table through raising revenue or cutting elsewhere to cover the cost of reform? And you want to know who's a for or who's against? Well, it depends on where you draw that price line. The higher the cost goes, the more support drops off, even within the Democratic Party.
And to that point, how much compromise do you expect, Jonathan?
Well, you know, again, I'm sort of avoiding hard predictions on this because the politics of this change, I mean, I'll be honest with you, just again, to use the public option as an example, I've supported the public option for a long time. If you'd asked me 7 months ago whether we'd still be talking about a public option, I would have said no way. This was something the Obama campaign put out to make the left happy. Democrats were talking about it. And as soon as they got into real discussions, they were going to drop this out of the discussion as a compromise. Far from it, it's very much part of the conversation. And in fact, I see the Obama administration, I see the Democrats, leaders in Congress, a lot of them pushing even harder for it. That tells me that politics on this aren't always so predictable. I think at the end of the day, it's going to depend a lot on how much Obama can get out in front of this and use his power to drive the conversation. And it'll depend on whether liberal interest groups who are supporting this can really get their boots on the ground, as they say, and make a big push for this. And then, you know, we'll see where the votes come. I couldn't predict with any certainty where it'll happen. Like I said, I feel confident there will be something signed in September, October, November. But what it is, I just don't know.
Gail Walensky,
I think it'll be all about what goes on in the Senate. I don't disagree with much of what Jonathan has said. This is very fluid. What is important to me is the attempts being made in the Senate by Baucus, by Conrad, to reach out to people like Grassley, Baucus's counterpart, and to other Republicans who have indicated an interest. Bennett drafted a bill a while ago with Ron Wyden showing an effort to be bipartisan. Olympia Snow and Susan Collins have indicated strong interest. Healthcare reform is so important. It affects the health and well-being of our whole country. It affects one-sixth of the economy. Having this result as a purely partisan vote would be very unfortunate, particularly in a going-forward basis when we hit some bumps in terms of legislation not quite working out exactly as people had hoped, which is generally the case with very complicated legislation.
And Jonathan, you've made the point that you don't need 60 Senate votes to pass health care, just to block a filibuster, right?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I've been talking with some people gaming out how this all works out in the end game. I wouldn't be at all surprised if you know, there's negotiations, and you may recall that there's what we call reconciliation rules written into the budget, which says that if by October 15th, both houses haven't passed health reform legislation, then it can move to this special process where you can't filibuster. So it would not surprise me if we get right up to the edge of that point and some kind of deal is struck where basically you get to a situation where the entire Democratic caucus and maybe one or two Republicans agreed that they won't filibuster reform. So Republicans, the rest of the Republicans will try to filibuster. You need 60 votes to break that filibuster. They'll break the filibuster. And then at that point, they'll go forward and they'll have maybe a series of votes. And there'll be a vote on just the public option. And maybe that'll pass with 51 votes or whatever public option compromise they've come up with. And parts of it will pass with 51 votes. But then there'll be one big vote on the parts of the program that everybody agrees on. And for that one, at the end, I would not be surprised if you see 60-plus votes. And the reason is pretty simple. I think at the end of the day, people like Gail was just talking about, I think they want to make something happen. And I also think people – you know, they are conscious of history. These are people who have been serving for a long time. They think about what are the history books going to say 30, 40, 50 years from now? Because if something passes, there's going to be that picture in the high school textbook. There's going to be Obama sitting there in the White House. And, you know, do they want to be remembered as the person who tried to block this or do they want to be the person who signed on? They want to be in that picture as supporting this great step forward, assuming it's something, you know, they can live with.
Back to the phones. Luke is on the line. He's in Hinesburg, Vermont. Luke, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Uh-huh. I guess I wanted to address two things. First, what I think is a misunderstanding or dishonesty on the part of the president in regard to the complaints of private insurers, which is that not so much that I think they're worried about the effectiveness of a public plan, you know, being a rival to their plan, but rather that the public plan will exist entirely outside any sort of profit and loss or, you know, pricing realm whatsoever, and that they'll be able to continue to receive funding and continue to spend money without having to really earn any profits, whereas private plans obviously have to contend with that. And secondly, I guess I'm wondering if it's so clear that a public plan can cut costs, why not start with existing public plans like Medicare and Medicaid? Thanks.
Luke, thank you. Gail Walensky, will you speak to that second point?
Yes. The issue that people are concerned about is that the public plan will act like Medicare, that is, price under the market in terms of services provided, and will use the power of government to do that. This would, if it, as happens in the over 65 population, push prices up higher in the private plans that don't have the power of government to set prices and make for a very unbalanced playing field between the public and the private plan. It's also a question of whether they actually would be subject to the same kinds of requirements in terms of reserve requirements and other requirements that insurance companies face. The profit issue is not really as relevant because we have a lot of not-for-profit insurance companies, but you do have to have a return on capital in order to sustain yourself even as a not-for-profit entity. Government, of course, doesn't even count its capital expenditures when it talks about expenditures. So there is some unevenness just going forward. But we ought to remember that Medicare, while it has lower prices, actually has not been able to develop sustainable spending. It also has unsustainable spending and has very much the a la carte fee-for-service medicine of the 1960s, very siloed treatment. It in no way represents the kind of healthcare delivery system or the kind of insurance we want to move to where you incent prevention and wellness and have a better balance between specialists and primary care. So Medicare sets low prices, but it actually doesn't do a very good job of controlling spending and especially doesn't do a good job of encouraging a better delivery of healthcare.
Here's another call from Detroit, Michigan. Michael is on the line. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
I think a number of good points were made by the last caller, and rather than get into the complexities that are being called up by the panel, I think that we need to just simplify this a little bit and realize that any public plan that's enabled is going to change over time as we finally get the American population to look at their health in a long-term basis, and we have to look at. There's other contributing factors, such as the food industry, which promotes obesity through the way that they process food. These things can all be taken into consideration on an ongoing basis, so long as profit motive is taken out of healthcare. I pay over $1,000 a month for Blue Cross for my wife and I, and the person running the Blue Cross office, plus a lot of his lieutenants, are making obscene salaries. So profit is there, but it's called a nonprofit because the profit is garnered up by the people running the program. Hmm. We have to take profit out of healthcare for our grandchildren, if not for anything else. And until we realize the moral implications of this, we will go nowhere as a country. And my businesses will suffer because my employees will suffer, and I want to be competitive. But I want this to be a public option with teeth, and it needs to be set up so that it will take the profit out of health care.
Glad you called, Michael. Thanks so much for your comments. Lisa's on the line. She's in Mason City, Iowa. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm all discombobulated after hearing the last caller because I was going to say, you know, when are people going to be held responsible for what they eat? You know, what's our own responsibility for health care? And I'm concerned that he thinks it's some people are shoveling food in our mouths. I mean, it's our choice.
Personal responsibility fitting into a public plan. Jonathan Cohn, would you speak to Lisa's point?
Sure. I'm a big believer in individual responsibility, and I've always been of the belief that a well-designed healthcare reform requires everybody to show responsibility. Now, there's a number of ways you do that. First of all, I think you require everyone to get insurance. It's part of your deal in the same way you pay your taxes for the fire department. Everybody has to get insurance. Now, we'll make it affordable for everybody. We'll help you get it if you can't buy it on your own, but everyone has to take that responsibility. I also think we need to encourage people as best we can to develop good habits. There's lots of ways you can do that. One of the reforms being talked about actually does focus a lot on giving employers, giving people incentives that, you know, if you are lead a healthy lifestyle, if you try to work on keeping your own health, then you're rewarded for that. Or you could look at it the other way. If you don't do these things, then you're penalized, however you want to see it. There are some companies that have had some limited success doing that with their own workforces. You hear a lot about Safeway as the famous company that everybody talks about with this. I think it's important to remember, as much as I am for individual responsibility, that at the end of the day, that's not going to solve the problem. That we have a systematic problem with our healthcare system. You want people to show individual responsibility, but you also have to create a system that protects everybody and that realizes that at the end of the day, the reason we're paying such high healthcare costs for our medical care system, isn't related strictly to the health habits of the eating habits, the exercise habits. That's part of why we're not a healthy society, but that's not why we're necessarily spending so much on our medical care.
Gail Walensky, I'm curious, what if we end up with a bill that isn't good enough? I mean, would it be better to just let it die, try again in a couple of years, as David Brooks just suggested in the New York Times a couple of days ago?
I don't think so. We can look at the Medicare Modernization Act that was passed in 2003, giving prescription drug benefits to seniors, something people felt has been needed for a long time. That was definitely, this was the best you were going to get, should you vote for it or not. Many Democrats chose the not. We need to get insurance coverage to the population, and we need to tackle some of these drivers of healthcare spending, and we need to get on with it. So it would have to be a pretty terrible bill for me to say, on balance, don't do it. If it is reasonable in terms of covering a large part of the uninsured and doesn't do great damage to the positive aspects of healthcare delivery and innovation in the United States, I think we ought to go forward. These opportunities only come periodically. It's embarrassing a country as rich as ours has 15% of the population without insurance, and we have unsustainable healthcare spending. We've got to start tackling it.
As I hear so many U.S. senators speak about this issue, I'd like to hear your thoughts lastly here. I hear so often the name of Senator Ted Kennedy, and I'm just curious how you think the senator's illness might provide some emotional leverage for passage of health care reform this year. Jonathan?
Well, I think it's very poignant that someone who has spent an entire political lifetime fighting for this, is on the verge of finally seeing this quest realized. And like I said, I think this is the best shot we've had quite possibly ever in the history of American politics. So I think it's a very poignant reminder. I will say that I think his absence is felt. He's pretty good at moving legislation, and it saddens me. I know it saddens a lot of his colleagues, even his adversaries, that he's not there for this. But I do think it's something to hold out. And I think a lot of people at the end of the day, I mean, I would not be surprised at the end of the day, somebody like Orrin Hatch signs on to a bill that maybe isn't his favorite bill, because he does have this close personal tie to Senator Kennedy and shares his ultimate goal of making health care affordable for everybody. So I do think it's a very poignant symbol.
Gail Wilensky, 10 seconds. What do you put the chances of health care reform this year?
Better than even, and I wish Kennedy was being more involved, because he would have helped bring the sides together. I'm afraid his absence will be felt on that, but it can still happen.
Gail Wilensky, economist and senior fellow at Project HOPE, International Health Education Foundation, former McCain advisor. Thanks so much for your time, Gail.
Thank you.
Jonathan Cohen writes The Treatment, the New Republic's healthcare blog, senior editor for The New Republic. I appreciate your time, Jonathan. Thanks.
Well, it was a pleasure to be here.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.